Good afternoon. I think we're going to get started. I'd like to try and, when we promise people an hour's conversation, we like to get people in and then let our speaker have a chance. I'm Johanna Mendelson-Forman with the Center for Strategic and International Studies Americas Program. And before I start with Ambassador Munoz, whom I hope you have a biography of, I'd like to also introduce my colleague, Philip McLean, who is a senior non-resident associate with us, and, of course, Michael Graybill, our program coordinator, Caitlin Watson, who is our program associate, our wonderful interns here at CSIS who make this possible. I also want to make a special thanks to Sarah Jackson Hahn of the United Nations Information. UNDP? I thought, sorry, Development Program, who actually reached out to us and helped make this possible. And then finally to my friend and colleague of many years, Ambassador Heraldo Munoz, for being willing to have be double billed in Washington in a city that has had many events and is winding down for the holidays, who was still going to join us here for an important conversation that we thought would be of use to all of you who are concerned about Latin America. And I think a very positive story that has taken place in the region, but also a story that is continuing in terms of dealing with the topics that the United Nations Development Program is concerned with. I'm not going to repeat the ambassador's very wonderful story. The biography is available to you. But I should point out that, and I have great respect because not only has he been a diplomat who has advanced so many issues in both multilateral forums and bilaterally, but he's also a wonderful scholar. And he's written most recently in The Dictator's Shadow, which is a book, a personal story about his life in the times of the dictatorship in Chile. But another book that I really like, which is about the role of a country like Chile in the Security Council during the debate that led up to the Iraq War. And I think for those of you who are interested, and many of you may know this, but others who don't, I always point out that Ambassador Munoz shared something very deep with Condi Rice at the time, having both been interns. Is that correct? In an office of Senator Worth.
Senator Hart
at the time, Congress when he was a congressman, right. And then Gary Hart when he was a senator. So those lessons run very deep, but they also are important lessons about not only how diplomacy functions, but what one can learn. And I strongly recommend that you take a look at the books. We promised that we would have a conversation, and that's precisely what we want to have, because I know you had an excellent presentation at the OAS earlier today. But we did have some slides to share, and I'm going to turn the floor over to Ambassador Munoz, and then we will be happy to have that conversation. So, Ambassador, please.
Well, Johanna, thank you very much for the invitation to speak here at CSIS, and thanks for the propaganda about my books. The last one, The Dictator's Shadow. Right. The Dictator's Shadow, by the way, I sold the movie rights. So buy the book because it may be in the movie sometime. Or even though they tell me that it's really complicated from a script to make it to a movie. So I'm not holding my breath. But let me speak a little bit about about the work that we're doing at the Bureau for Latin America, the Caribbean of UNDP, and some of the priorities, which basically for the purposes of this presentation are let's say, three or four. Number one, the issue of poverty and inequality, which is a fundamental challenge in Latin America. Then second, the role of the state, which has been changing dramatically in the region. And third, the challenge of citizen security, which is, as I will explain, a absolutely top priority in the region. But I'll begin by saying that Latin America is passing through perhaps one of its best periods in history because there's a coincidence of several tendencies. First, from the point of view of democratic governance, this is a region that has experienced electoral democracy for perhaps the longest period in history. This year, six presidential elections have been held, mostly without any major issues about results in the last one in Guyana, and before that in Argentina, in Nicaragua, in Guatemala, in Peru, in Haiti. In Haiti, in the case of Haiti, was a historical, absolutely a groundbreaking fact that one president elected democratically delivered the presidency to another one elected democratically. It never happened before. So from the point of view of democratic governance, the region lives a very good period, even though there's a question about the quality of democracy, which is something else. But for those of us who fought dictatorships, it is absolutely fundamental to live in countries where the right of habeas corpus is recognized and you don't have to fear that somebody will slam your door, throw your door down and pick you up and take you somewhere and become a victim of a dictatorship. So that's one tendency that coincides with another one. Latin America has been growing economically for a decade now. And looking at the first slide, you will see that the Latin America has been, between 2003 and 2010, has been growing at an average of about 4.3, and in fact 4.2, and in fact in 2010 it was 6.2. So that we're talking about a very vigorous trend, and this year will probably be around 4.5, and even it all depends on what happens in Europe, basically. If the situation does not sink to the bottom, we will grow around 4%, perhaps a little bit more. If it doesn't, well, let's begin praying, because this is there's never been a recession like the one that will be if the situation in Europe goes worse. But the region has withstood better the international crisis than many other regions, and that's because of causes that I will go in briefly. At the same time, the other positive trend is that not only has been the region democratic with economic growth, but poverty has been declining. And then in the next slide, you can see the declining trend of poverty and extreme poverty in the region. This is basically because most countries of Latin America have been implementing conditional cash transfer programs that have made a big difference in diminishing poverty. Programs such as Bolsa Familia in Brazil, like Chile Solidaridad in Chile, or Oportunidades in Mexico, or Solidaridad in Dominican Republic. Today, one out of six Latin Americans is covered by some form of conditional cash transfer program. They vary, but the impact has been noticeable in terms of reducing poverty and improving particularly education, primary education, and health. So this is a very favorable trend. In fact, if you look at the next slide, even inequality has declined slightly. And I would underline slightly. Measured by the Gini coefficient, you can see that on average, during the last decade, about 1% in the improvement in terms of the inequality. In the study that we did at UNDP, out of 18 countries, 14 had reduced inequality. However, and this is, I'm going into some of the problems now. However, the region continues to be the most unequal region in the world, measured again by the Gini coefficient. We are the champions of inequality, and even though advances have been made, we have the bad medal of being the most unequal in the world. Out of the 15 most unequal countries of the world, in a study that we did in the first Human Development Report for Latin America and the Caribbean that we did last year, 2010, We said that out of 15, the 15 was unequal, 10 are in Latin America. So this is a huge problem. And when you, again, measure by the Gini coefficient, compared to other regions, we are even more unequal than sub-Saharan Africa. So this is a major challenge for the region. In the next slide, you will see that the inequality is so huge that the best-performing country of Latin America, in other words, the most egalitarian country of the region, which is Uruguay, is more unequal than the most unequal of the OECD, which is the United States. Mm-hmm. So Uruguay doing such a good job, it's more unequal than the most unequal of the OECD and more unequal than most of the most unequal of Europe, which is Portugal. When I went to present the study to Uruguay, by the way, I was with President Mujica, whom some of you know. He's a man of deep common sense, very wise, but he has the wisdom of a man of the countryside because he's a farmer. And when I presented, I had an interview with him before the presentation, and I began explaining the results, and I said, well, President, you should be very proud because you're always the most egalitarian. But I said, however, and I told him about this, you are more unequal than the most unequal of the developed countries. And he said, okay, I understand. So this is like soccer, where we are champions, but of the fourth division, you know? So he said that in the presentation, and the next day, you know, the headlines of the newspapers were Uruguay champions of the fourth division, you know? So that's a problem. And it's a major issue because, let's see the next slide. We've, at UNDP, as you very well know, there's a Human Development Index that has become sort of a standard about going beyond economic growth to measure countries. And the rankings that take into account income per capita, education, and health, we improved it last year by adding the inequality factor. And we thought, okay, so what happens when we factor in inequality to the Human Development Index? What happens is that, on average, in the case of Latin America and the Caribbean, countries fall 26.1% in their values of the Human Development Index. In other words, when we think that we're doing relatively well because of the Human Development Index and we factor in inequality, then we realize that we're not doing that well. And some countries drop, as is the case of Bolivia, 34.1% in their Human Development Index value. So this is something that it's a major, major preoccupation, and this presents various challenges. Where we think that countries of the region have to design strategies that go specifically to the most vulnerable groups. We've said inequality is not only income. Inequality is ethnic, is gender, is territorial. So we should talk about inequalities in plural and design policies that go after inequality. We said it is fine to combat poverty. Latin America has done well in combating poverty. Now you have to go beyond that, continue to combat poverty, but now combat inequality. It is a top issue of the agenda, UNDP is telling Latin American countries and most presidents and heads of state and government and ministers are coming back to us and say, yes, we agree, help us to tackle this. And we've been recommending the way to tackle it, improving the effectiveness of universal access programs because there's a question of quality. Because even though coverage in education has improved, the conditional cash transfers, as I said, is a factor. Politics of inclusion have improved in the region. However, still there are issues of quality. The quality of the services vary greatly. This explains what happens in Chile, for example, when the protests that are going on, which are basically protests of the middle class. Because in Chile today, out of 10 university students, 7 come from a family that has, for the first time, someone in college. But what they're protesting is about the cost, the huge high cost of university studies, and the disparities in quality of what is being offered. So this is increasingly what we're seeing, and we think that there has to be an improvement in terms of quality, and we have to make sure that we tackle other issues like the sustainability of these social policies, including through tax reform, through what we said should be fiscal pacts. In other words, we need to improve the pressure, the tax pressure, because it's still very low in the region, with the exception of Brazil, for example, that has about 33%, but in some cases it's 10% or below 10%, which is shameful. If one wants to sustain social policies in the long term. And in addition to that, as you know, the tax structure in Latin America is very regressive. They are basically taxes to consumption, indirect taxes, instead of being direct and to property. And in addition to that, you have evasion, tax evasion. So we think that a major issue in order to continue to make advances and inroads in poverty and inequality is to do tax reform, and to do it through consensus, because this is a very delicate, politically loaded issue. And unless you can begin a process of dialogue, in order to agree on tax reform, it will not be done, evidently. People, particularly those that will have to pay more, will say, well, it's not an issue of just having more taxes. It's a question of how do you spend the taxes. They will always say that. So yeah, I've been saying, when I was in Peru with President Humala, he said, no, you should speak about that. And I said, we need more taxes, but we need to spend well, both things. And we think that that's part of a major issue that is right around the corner in Latin America. Nevertheless, what continues to be true is that, and here's the issue about the return of the state. Why has all this occurred, despite the challenges that are ahead? Because the state has returned in Latin America. And the state has returned to spend on social policies and to implement programs that a decade ago would have been seen as absolutely rejectable. When the policy is used to be in many countries, the more neoliberal perspective of a minimal state with a maximum market. Well, all of that is behind now, and you have governments that are right-wing, centrist, or left implementing very aggressive public policies to combat poverty, to address issues of social security, to combat crime, etc. But the state is back. Not only is it supposed to be leave it to the market and the invisible hand will take care of it, or even the so-called Washington Consensus, all of that is behind, and you see a discussion in Latin America that is so different from one here in the United States, by the way, where here the discussion seems to be less state, less government. In Latin America seems to be much more balanced. Not that we are going back to the statism of the 60s. That's not it. Because most of them in the region are committed to responsible fiscal policies, to a very fundamental role of private markets, etc. And it's not that, to macroeconomic equilibria. It's rather that that's not enough. We need a active state, and that is reflected in this graph where you can see how social public expenditure has been very much above the public expenditure in general. So that means that governments are putting more resources into social policies. And they're doing that by moving around items in their budgets and by the few taxes that have increased, which has not been very much, putting it into social policies. And that reflects, in a way, the return of the state. And when you look at the next social public expenditure per capita, you see more or less the distribution. Some countries really making a huge jump in from 1990 to 2008, which is the last figures that that are comparable here. So the state is back. And we said, so the state is back. How is this reflected in terms of the results? Okay, there's been more spending. There's been reduction in poverty. But what about the other components of social policy? So we invented, and we just presented to the Ibero-American Summit in Paraguay a few weeks ago, a social citizenship index, which is a combination of the Human Development Index, but with other elements like gender equality measurements, measurements of the carbon footprint of countries in the region. It's much more. And we came out with this result. This is a spider web where what you see is the red line is the measurement in 2000, and the blue is 2010. And what you perceive there is all countries improve. All countries improve, some more than others. You can look at Venezuela, a major improvement. In Brazil, a very significant improvement. Peru, a very significant improvement. Colombia, and some others that the improvement is modest. Chile, for example, not very big. Because we're talking 2010, that had been already 10 years of the Concertación that had been investing a lot, and so the improvements continue, but they're not as radical in some other countries. And, of course, those that are perform better are Uruguay, Argentina, Chile, which perform better also in the Human Development Index of UNDP. So that in that sense, the panorama doesn't change that radically, but we do find some issues that are very very interesting in terms of you can see the advances much more quickly. So I think this is part of what I was trying to say. Governments are worried about social policies. They're putting money. The state is active, and there is progress. In the next, to make it easier, this is put in a different perspective with bars where you can see the improvement and how marked it is in some countries. Bolivia, by the way, is a big jump. But then Bolivia starts at a much lower position, needless to say. Finally, with this I'll finish. So all of this is a very positive panorama. But like in the background, and more than in the background, it's like the elephant in the room. There's an issue of citizen security that has to do with democratic governance and has to do with development. And increasingly you are seeing that citizen security is the top priority in Latin America. It so happens that Latin America is not only the most unequal region of the world, it is the most violent. Latin America represents 9% of the world population, but it concentrates 27% of the homicides. And when you look at homicides per 100,000 population, it is a really sad fact that Latin America has an average of about 26 murders per 100,000, when the world average is 4. But when you look at some countries, particularly in Central America, we're talking above 50, about 60, and last year the world record of homicides was Honduras with 78 murders per 100,000 population. And when you disaggregate, as I was speaking to Governor Navarro Wolf, Governor Nariño, in some areas of his department in Colombia, we're talking about well above 100 murders per 100,000 population. And the same thing happens in areas of Guatemala or in El Salvador and Honduras. So this is an absolutely major issue, and comparatively speaking then to other regions of the world, you can see there in the bars how we're doing. And these are the most modest figures. They are not the figures that that look at the sub-regional situations like that of Central America. This has a cost in terms of democracy, because today crime and the crime cartels are penetrating, infiltrating parliaments, the police, the judiciary, and they have becoming a cancer that is could threaten democracy. And at the same time, the development impact is major. And that's why we've initiated at UNDP a major project on citizen security in Latin America based on something that we did in Central America a couple of years back and something that we're concluding now in the Anglophone Caribbean that will be ready in a month or so and that we will launch in Trinidad and Tobago. On the basis of that, we're doing this major report and with the idea of offering policy suggestions to governments, and we have constituted a very high-level team of researchers and an advisory board of the highest level that you could think, in with many presidents, former presidents, and people like the former police chief of New York, and well, a lot of very distinguished individuals who will join as the head of IDB, the head of the OAS, the head of ECLAC. So it's to tackle this because in the end, and this is what public opinion is thinking, this is something about what I was saying at the beginning, despite the fact that we are in a world economic crisis, it so happens that the top priority, according to Latino Barometer, in Latin America, even including unemployment, and et cetera, it's crime. Crime is 20% of those polled said that this was a top priority, and only 19% said last year that this was that it was in the economy. So, using that dictum of a presidential campaign in this country, one could say it's not the economy stupid; it's crime stupid. At least in Latin America, as it looks like. So, this is what we're trying to do, and the idea is to do so, to respond to the challenges of a Latin America that still has a lot of problems, that still has a lot of challenges, but without a doubt, that has achieved a great deal. And that has to be recognized at a moment when we see Europe and we see the United States mired in uncertainty about what to do. In the end, maybe Latin America could serve for some modest lessons for those that are passing through worst times that we are. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Ambassador Munoz, for that very comprehensive overview of what is taking place. And we obviously want to have everybody participate, but I have a question that came to mind in this is my academic prerogative, perhaps, but you hailed the return of the state, and I think everybody agrees that there has been great progress in elections and consolidation of democracy. But I guess as someone who spent her life studying conflict, one of the indicators of conflict is that you have more than 1,000 deaths per year caused by different sources where the state has no control. And while I'm not comparing Latin America to a conflict zone, the statistics on the pervasiveness of crime with an average of 26 deaths per 100,000 tends to suggest that the state has a long way to go, even if it's not a conflict zone. And I understand you just announced the Citizen Security Initiative. But I wondered if you could comment on where you think in these various types of statistics the state needs to invest its money, because it's not to make the comparison, but to think that if you're going to keep the state strong and support the citizens, it's going to need to do better in this one area that you've pointed out. Mm-hmm. So perhaps sure. I can start with that.
No, I fully agree. I mean, the return of the state, however, is not sufficient to tackle some of the major issues like the fact that the state in some cases does not control its own territory in some countries. And that, I think, requires a more vigorous state, but a better, more efficient state, and it requires international cooperation. There's practically no cooperation among Latin American countries except when ministers of security meet occasionally and they exchange in an ad hoc fashion, they exchange information on intelligence. But the crime cartels as transnational, so you need across the board cooperation among Latin American countries, and that's one part of the fact. The other one is that the resources in the past have never gone to do a good work of reinforcing the police, they're reinforcing the judiciary. This is an issue that is beginning now. So that if you don't have that, how can you control your territory? When you have a situation like Guatemala where this calculated that there's about 120,000 private security guards and the armed forces and the police are no more than 33,000. In other words, the private police is three times that of the armed forces, the security forces in general. So here there's a pending issue. But I agree with you. The return of state doesn't mean that the state has full control in the case of crime, because it is weak, the state, with regard to this issue. At least many countries of the region are. And this is, I think, a challenge that requires sets of policies precisely to avoid that weakness of the state as regards transnational crime.
I see two hands. Let's take questions in pairs. Kelly, if you go first, and then Phil, if you'd like to follow.
Great. Thank you, Johanna, and thank you, Ambassador, for your presentation. As I'm looking at your second slide on the poverty trends and your comments about the middle class, this is a little bit of a squishy question, but I'd like your reaction to it, because I think, you know, spending as much time thinking about Brazil and the Southern Cone as I do, and obviously living through what our country is going through right now, you know, it strikes me that where you see potential instability politically is where the middle class is somehow in flux. So our middle class right now is feeling like it's losing ground. So you've got the Occupy Wall Street, the 99% movement, et cetera. On the other hand, as you noted, in Chile, the middle class is going up and perhaps kind of seeing, opening its eyes, the first folks going to college, et cetera, seeing, okay, I'm in a better spot, but I still see that some of those other people are better off than I am, and I don't like that. So then that also creates some churn. And then looking at the Brazil situation, you know, folks are, I think, rightly so, very optimistic about Brazil, very complimentary of the conditional cash transfer programs, et cetera, which you also mentioned. But something that at least I worry about as I look at Brazil is you've got a middle class that historically, when they were lower class, was pretty quiet politically, socially, and frankly just put up with a lot of disenfranchisement and lack of power in the political realm. And I guess I worry a little bit if the, you know, their economic numbers slip at all, what happens to that middle class if they start to feel, not hopefully not as dramatically as we're feeling right now in the United States, but to start to feel a bit of slippage. And so just kind of your musings on how you at UNDP are looking at these middle class dynamics and the impact they have on political stability. So thanks.
Let me just come in. Geraldo, my question is much simpler than Kelly's. And that is, in Latin America, in a decade ago, if you did surveys, you found that people identified democracy with good economic performance. That is to say, they were in favor of a democracy if it meant good economic performance. Mm-hmm. And the numbers shifted very close to being negative when the economies were going down. So that in people's eyes, the performance economy in some ways was better, was more important than what was really happening on the democracy mm-hmm. front. So I guess the question is, will Latin American democracy survive when inevitably there is a downturn of some sort in, mm-hmm. in the future in the yeah. economic side?
Sure. Well, let me begin there. What the last numbers of the polling that has been done region-wide demonstrate that there's not a growing insatisfaction with democracy. What there is, though, is a growing insatisfaction with the traditional forms of political representation. In other words, there is distrust and even rejection of politics as we know it, but it's within democracy. In other words, there's not a questioning of democracy, it's a question of traditional politics, rather. That's what we observe mainly. And there's a slight decline of the appreciation for democracy in the last one, the one that just came out of the Latino Barometro. But in my talks with the researchers, what they interpreted is more as they want to send a message that there is discontent, and that the issue, however, is not the democratic system as such. It seems to be very clear. So, in a way, I think that that pattern that you alluded to of the past has changed. I mean, people have appreciated enough democracy to understand that there's no toying with authoritarianism or with other forms. I don't think anybody in Latin America wants to go back to military coups, and that as a scenario, I think, is virtually non-existent. However, the questioning of political parties, of traditional politicians, all of that is very much active because of this mobilization that there is. And that, I think, is fed by this growing middle class. Whether a decline in the economy will lead to insatisfaction, Skelly was asking, and it's up to be seen. The difference today from yesterday is that today there are social safety nets that didn't exist in the past. So that even if there's a slide, today there are enough resources that have been put aside in many countries of the region for unemployment insurance, for all kinds of other programs that will probably protect the most vulnerable when that didn't happen even a decade ago. This is a question of the last decade. There were some few countries that had unemployment insurance, but very few. I even remember that in the case of Chile, this was during the Lagos administration, which I was remember that this was truly put in place. So today there's safety nets that I think will avoid that there is, if there is a decline, and the poverty rates. As you know, poverty is, the experts know that this is, poverty is a very, it's a complicated category. It's very much in flux. It can change rapidly. So that if there is a decline, the perception I have today is that there are safety nets that would allow then for this not becoming a factor of political instability. That would be my perception. Now, since I was just in Brussels, my perception is changing a little bit about what may happen in the future because the situation is so delicate, is so negative, that if the thing continues to go down the road, and here there are problems because members of the EU, that they cannot adjust as Latin Americans did in the past by way of inflation, for example, because they don't have their own currency. You know, I mean, Italy could not do the physical adjustment that has been asked is impossible. It will not be made. And default is prohibited under the treaty. And so the other way would be to do it by way of inflation. And since you don't have your own currency, you can't do it. So the situation is like a catch-22 type. I came back, I was feeling a bit more negative about what may happen in Europe and therefore in the rest of the world, unless some of these countries can go out of the Eurozone, which is a possibility, but that presents other difficulties. So if that happens, I don't see how Latin America can stay out as it has done so far. It will affect us. And what happens in China will also affect us, because if there's the decline of demand and there has been a slight decline, the boom of commodities that is supporting all of these good years in Latin America may be up in question. But I wouldn't put myself in that category yet. But all of these middle classes, the interesting thing is they're more demanding of the state. These are more active citizens. They want universal. They want rights. You know, it's very different from the past. They know their rights. They demand them. They want them to be universal. They want their lives to be better. And in that sense, it's a different type of citizenship that you're finding now. I mean, and you find it everywhere. And that they mobilize for all the issues that they feel are unfair, unjust. A group of Chileans before the students mobilized in a question of less than 24 hours to protest the installation of a carbon-based electric plant near a environmentally a reserve in the north of Chile. President immediately canceled it. The indigenous peoples in Bolivia protest a highway. The issue is pulled back. In Peru, the protests in Cajamarca because of the gold mining that leads to even a cabinet change. I mean, at least it's a activation of it. The protests in the streets of throughout the streets of Mexico against violence and crime. You're seeing new phenomenon in the region. The students mobilizing in Colombia, mobilizing exactly for quality education, for cheaper access to education. So my feeling is that today there's a larger challenge in the region than there was, and this more politically conscious people that of this middle classes are more citizens now than they were in the past.
Thank you. There was once, I'll call on you in a minute, there was a famous phrase that Tina Rosenberg wrote about elections in Latin America about 15 years ago, and she said, well, we've created elections, but now we have to create citizens. So I think what you said is really rather optimistic that we are reaching the point of creating citizens. Yes, please go ahead. And if you wouldn't mind using the microphone.
Okay. There we go. Hi. My question is the following. I wanted to know your views a little bit about the resource curse in the matter of hindering equality and democracy, especially considering that a lot of countries in Latin America are oil-producing countries such as Venezuela and Ecuador, and how the rise of commodity prices can actually be a downturn mm-hmm. to all of these variables.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. But if you look at it, when prices were low, countries did not make much of an effort to diversify. There are a few exceptions. Chile made an effort to begin a process of diversification of exports and depend less of copper, and copper began going down and down and down in terms of the earning of foreign exchange, but that has gone back up again. So this is a curse; it's a temptation, but I think it all depends on what governments do with the money. Today they're doing wiser things. I mean, they began. Many countries like Brazil, like Chile, we then encountered cyclical policies that have been one of the reasons why we cope better with the international economic crisis. The other one was we have more regulations on banking than other countries, so that these exotic products, speculative products, were much more controlled because of the regulation of banking. Again, more state involved. So the challenge today would be, will Latin America take advantage of this moment of commodity boom to change its productive structures, to add more innovation, to add more knowledge, to add more value to our exports. And this is something that I think is still a question mark. There are many that think that it all depends, that not all commodities are the same, that agricultural commodities create employment, that is different because you can add technology and value even for primary goods. In the case of Chile, we learned that, the exports of fruits, for example, created a series of other technological advances. I mean, Chile began exporting whole industries of packaging, of environmentally safe packaging that we didn't have before. And since we wanted to export to Europe, we couldn't, the tougher laws prohibited the nails and all that. And, well, today Chile exports not only the fruits, but the packaging industry. And all kinds of technology were added to, the exports in cold, in just in time in the markets. So technology is added, value is added. So there's a discussion that is not so clear. But to me, evidently there is the need to add more knowledge, to add more innovation, and not to repeat a cycle of dependency on primary goods. And that's something that I think that there is a possibility. There's a discussion. But, of course, when copper is so high or oil is so high, the temptation is very big. It's there, let's continue to do this. So I recognize that as one major challenge that's still pending.
Let's take this next question, please.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm Vicky Gass with WOLA. Good to see you again. I just have a question concerning the Citizen Security Initiative, and if you could tell us a little more about it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I have to thank WOLA because they gave me an award for my book, but The Dictator Shadow. I won the best book award that WOLA and Duke University give to the best book in English on Latin America, human rights, and democracy. So I thank you for that. On the citizen security, the idea was born out of the request by presidents and foreign ministers to that UNDP should help them in tackling and understanding better how to best tackle the problem in security. Our purpose is not to do an academic study, even though we want it to be very well based on solid research. But our idea is to offer policy recommendations after we go through a very thorough analysis of the data or what others have said, because much has been said on the subject. We're not going to discover the wheel, but we think that we can make inroads from the perspective of human development. That's our angle. There are others that can do better the merely police repression type of work. We want to look at what is the consequence of crime and violence and insecurity on human development. We have some clues that have been studies done by the World Bank, and they calculated that in the case of El Salvador, the crime in 1 year cost the equivalent of the total taxation of the country. We've done a very small study that we presented at the Guatemala summit recently, where we calculated that all Central American countries spend directly on police and control activities $4 billion a year, and that's money that doesn't go to health, doesn't go to education, and that even then that's insufficient. So we want to look at that, and we want to look at also the perspective of human rights, because what we observe is that generally what's going on in Latin America is, because people are so worried about citizen security, the reaction is, okay, let's build more jails, let's toughen the bills, let's lower the age of criminal responsibility. In one country, it has been lowered to 12 years old, by the way. So where do we stop for there? I mean, so we believe that we have to take the different perspective, but in order to recommend anything to governments, we want to have a good dialogue with experts, dialogue with political leaders, be very well based, you know, to say what we have to say. And our suspicion is that you have to put a lot more money in prevention, a lot more money in local communities, doing preventive work, a lot more money in the revamping of the prison system, a lot more money into the police in numbers and quality. There are clues that if you increase the number of police, there's a decline in crime. But it's up to a certain point. After a point, there's a plateau. So we want to take a look at that. We think there has to be a lot more cooperation among countries. We think that the dialogue with the U.S. must continue so as to tackle issues like the consumption side and the supply of weapons. I know that this is very, I mean, this it would be naive to even pose an issue like that in this and the next year. But when there's a new administration, one has to begin looking at all the weapons that are in the arms of criminals come from the U.S. in 80%. And all the armories that are located near the border, as the president of Mexico has complained, I don't know how many times, he's totally right about that. And now that we know that there's been money laundering being made, and not only the arms being sent for, you know, try to find out where they go, all of that requires the cooperation of others as well. So it has to be an integral perspective, we suspect. Otherwise, it will all be short-lived. And there has to be repression. I mean, we cannot have a sociological perspective, no, no, we have to eliminate poverty and we have to be more unequal and maybe in a decade. No, the person that has a son who's been kidnapped or somebody, robbery, they want answers. So you have to have better repression, but at the same time within rule of law. So that's the perspective that we're taking, and we're inviting various actors to join with us in this analysis, where, again, our perspective is more the development perspective, the angle where we think we can do much better. And we're optimistic because putting together the team, we've had a tremendous positive reaction on everyone. And as I said, several sitting presidents, former presidents, and, well, the head of the OAS involved in this, the head of ECLAC, the head of IDB, several others that will join us in this advisory board that the study will seek to have their views and their opinions and their perspectives. We've involved other parts of the system. For example, in the United Nations UNODC, the United Nations Office for Drugs and Crime in Vienna, we've invited them because it's a perspective that we want to know. But at the same time, we invited the High Commissioner of Human Rights in Geneva. So that's more or less the project. And we hope to complete it by early 2013, mid-2013, to be realistic, and put out our publication and begin a dialogue with governments, by the spring of 2013. That would be our goal.
Will there be opportunities for civil society?
Yes. The idea is that we can have, once we have some drafts that we discuss with, our idea will be to go to some key countries and at some points to do like small workshops with various actors, including civil society, so as to have their perspective. But this would be a little bit down the road, probably beginning the second half of 2012.
We have time for maybe another one round of questions, and we promised our speaker we'd get him out on time. So, yes.
Hi. You mentioned earlier that you were in the OAS, mm-hmm. and I wanted to see what your opinion was regarding the sustainability and the future of the OAS, considering that earlier this year, the U.S. Congress wanted to reduce or completely eliminate its funding to the OAS. And I read an article recently, I don't know if it's true, that even Brazil was threatening with pulling out their quota that they own to the OAS, and also with the creation of CELAC, and whether or not you feel that Latin America needs another forum for dialogue similar to the OAS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the creation of CELAC is something very different from the OAS, because CELAC will be a forum for coordination and, as we say in Spanish, concertación. Basically, it replaces the Rio Group. So it doesn't have an institutional structure. It doesn't have headquarters to speak of. It doesn't have a bureaucracy. It will be something much looser. And evidently, this would not be comparable to the OAS that has a structure, has what we know. And my perception is that that the OAS plays a very significant role in some areas, despite the fact that it has many weaknesses. For certain, it's human rights structures, the commission and the court, to begin. But in several other areas, electoral observation, for example, or even the juridical institutional components, because there are treaties, conventions that are based at the OAS, there's a Summit of the Americas, etc., that it's unique OAS, difficult to create elsewhere. So, you know, I've seen periods when many people have said, oh, the OAS is going to disappear and never dies. It's hard to kill. And my perception will be that will be the case. And in the end, in the past, I've been very frustrated. I was deputy foreign minister, and I was about to cut the throat of one institution that I will not name here. And I had convinced my president that we needed to take a look at the whole issue of institutions in the Americas. But before I could tell him what I wanted to do, the secretary general of that organization called them to please ask for payment of the quota of Chile. And the president, in a moment of weakness, because I hadn't had the dialogue. No, presidents are never weak. At a moment of decision that he made, he said, okay, we're going to pay. And since he paid, we couldn't do it. So then, from then on, I became convinced that practically no institution has been created in Latin America will ever disappear. So they'll live there, half live, you know, with secretary generals asking for quota payments and all that. So in the end, you have to be pragmatic. You have to be eclectic. Some institutions are good for some things, others for some other things. But we should safeguard those who have contents and where there are instruments. And they were used as instruments. As the Santiago Commitment to Democracy, Resolution 1080, the Washington Protocol, and the Charter. And these are very important instruments that one should safeguard, in my view. So even though some presidents might want to do away with the OAS, I think others may disagree, and some will give more salience to their profile in some institutions than in others, and will probably be more generous with some institutions than in others. In some cases, a question of prestige, because you know, the institution is located in their country, or that country was the one that took the initiative for the creation of that particular agency or institution. So long as the United States has an interest in the OAS, and the U.S. will never not have an interest, at least a minimal interest, and so long as Latin Americans have an interest, and my feeling is that many of them will always do with the OAS, I think it will continue. So I don't see it disappearing, but the budget issues that you mentioned, the quota problems, are not new. And sometimes countries have not paid for different reasons, and I know what you're saying about this two particular countries that you mentioned, but and that always creates very severe difficulties for the personnel and for even for the activities. But my prediction would be that the OAS will be around for some time.
I have to say, even Raul Castro said that to Chavez. There was a quote that when he announced at CELAC that he wanted to do away with the OAS, he was counseled by Raul that it was probably too early to announce its death. So I think pragmatism has its power. I think we are probably at the end of our time. There are two questions up, but maybe in, out of courtesy, these two gentlemen would like to ask a question. Why don't you ask it, and we'll get a brief response.
Hi, my name is Hurley Meyer from the Pan American Development Foundation, also a Chilean. Mm-hmm. My question actually...
Not everybody's perfect.
That's right, that's right. Same as my English. you mentioned, of course, we talked about the inequality throughout Latin America and facing a lot of our work, you know, we rely on government funding, especially from the United States, to implement many of our development projects. And how do you see that reduction over time impacting inequality in Latin America? And you know, what is your reaction to that in general?
And this gentleman
here? Yes. Well, my question has to do with how is the recession actually impacting the work that UNDP does, particularly in the case of Latin America, because we know that there's a shortage of resources when it comes to international cooperation, and apparently... Yeah, I was a former UNDP staff, and I know it's actually affecting the operations of UNDP in the field. So, I was wondering.
Well, the two questions are very much related. So, I would have to say that that there's a decline of contribution by, let's say, traditional donors to most, if not all, international agencies, and we've been hit quite hard. I cannot be denied. Many of them are European. The Europeans are feeling the squeeze. And with the exception of the Scandinavians that have not been so badly hit, that maintain more or less their contributions, the rest have declined very significantly. How much can that impact the work that we do on inequality, on other social issues? It may, because we have to cut. I mean, there's no other way. I mean, just you have less funding, you have to cut your expenses. So, for instance, my bureau, we are doing adjustments. And I have 26 national offices throughout the region and one regional center in Panama. So from New York, I've told them, you know, I have to begin cutting. And I've set up goals or percentages of cuts that they have to do. And at the same time, I've said you have to do more, you have to deliver more. So it's a two-way street. You can not only cut, but you can do more efforts to raise money. Most of the funding that we get is from governments of the region who want to work with us in certain areas. So they fund, they co-fund a lot. We put money and they put money. So in many cases, there are issues that are absolutely a priority for them, so that money will be around for us. But for regional projects, for example, regional projects come all from either a regular budget, which for us is very small, or from programs that we have from abroad. So if there are successful areas, though, the money will be there. If there are interesting projects, I think the money will be there. For example, you know, we've done some work relatively well valued, apparently, on Afro descendants in Latin America, mm-hmm. and we have a country that has come to us to actually offer us to continue that project and fund mm-hmm. more of what we were doing, which to a very good surprise of us. And there are other areas where I think that people are seeing that we're doing a good work. My perception in Brussels, even though I was hesitant to go because of the crisis. I found that there was a very positive response to what we're doing, and I wouldn't discount that some resources could get from there. But traditional donors, they have been declining, and this is a problem without a doubt. So this is affecting UNDP. In some cases, some countries are saying, well, we want more results, and tell us. Well, we do capacity building. Well, tell us what capacity building is. And sometimes it's difficult to say, you know. Okay, you know, we train people. People are better at their work. How can that be measured? Mm-hmm. So sometimes donors are a bit unfair mm-hmm. about showing the results. So we're trying to be better at telling our story One has to be better at telling our story to see how you affect lives. So that's one of the challenges that we have.
Well, Ambassador Munoz, I know we could spend another hour and we probably wouldn't answer everybody's questions, but I do think this has been a very valuable bit of time for us to get a better sense. You've told the story very, very well, and I think you've given a lot of people opportunity and inspiration to think a little bit more about it. So let's give our speaker a hand after a long day.